Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Marco Tovar on the show. Marco is a Fresno-based photographer and educator specializing in wet pate Kaleiden process, which is a photographic process from the 1850s, which Marco uses to document the people of the Central Valley. In this conversation, we dig into the weeds of photography, discussing his wet plate process, but also many other things related to cameras, post-production, and a lot more. Please enjoy our conversation, and Baker will take us there. Investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best! Marco, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Oh, boy. Is this like one? Am I telling you about one location or can I?
It's just like taking your temperature on like what you're enjoying right now.
Yeah. So right now, well, since I've been in Fresno, La Elegante is one of my favorite spots for tacos. I actually haven't, it used to be kind of a ritual like Saturday. I haven't done that in a while. I'm kind of sticking to my own neighborhood. So Moto, which is right across the street from Fresno High. Very convenient walk across the street for lunch. Where else? El Premio on Shields and Murrah is always a kind of go-to weekly thing. So
what's your standard taqueria order?
It depends on the taqueria. So like La Elegante is two adobada tacos I've talked to other people about this. It's like, you go to certain places for certain things.
Yeah.
And when I think of tacos, those two places stand out for me, but there's so many options in Fresno. It's like, I feel like I need to spend a whole summer just exploring.
Agreed. Now, when you're thinking about what makes a good torta for you, what goes into it?
I think with a lot of sandwiches, the bread is super important. So, I mean, it's kind of a standard type of bread they use for a torta, but it has to be grilled enough on the inside to kind of hold everything together so it doesn't get soggy. So a little bit of crunch on the inside is good.
Because when you have that layer of refried beans that's been kind of slathered on, if you have a soggy bread, you know, it's kind of like when chilaquiles is done poorly where it gets too soggy and you lose all sense of toothsomeness. Maybe, is that a word? Maybe toothsomeness. And so like sometimes folks will attempt to make chilaquiles at home and they'll grab some store-bought tortilla chips and then they'll slather them with sauce and they'll be like, why is it not the same? It's because they have to be freshly fried. So they have that internal structure that you need to maintain that. You know, this difficulty that some people have with non-crunchy textures. Do you find that to be true?
Yes.
Okay. And what I've often speculated. Do you have any speculations as to why that is? Is it just American food is just so fried that it's like there's no sense of like a balance between soft and crunchy? Or what do you think it is?
That's a good perspective, I think. I think the more you travel and the more like cultural experience you have with foods, the more you realize that like those textures are kind of a common denominator. And so when you're back here, you're looking for those things.
Yeah.
People need to get out more. I don't know.
Yeah. I do think it's, you get used to what you know.
Yeah.
Let's stop ourselves before we go too far down talking about soggy chips. We're going to talk about photography, which is not related to soggy chips. And I'm going to start you with a number of questions about kind of early stages of learning and thinking about cameras. So I want to start with kind of a simple one. So let's say you're going to two birthday parties. Let's say a niece and a nephew, for example.
Okay.
And one is 7 and one is 17. And their parents have asked you to buy them their first camera. So what camera would you buy for a 7-year-old? And what camera would you buy for a 17-year-old?
Yeah, I teach photography. And so I'm with a lot of 17-year-olds, and I also have a niece, two nieces, who are around the 7, 9 year old age.
Perfect.
So I think with the 7-year-old, probably like an instant, like a Polaroid mini. I think I actually bought my niece Maya that Polaroid when she was around 7 or 8. Now she's in middle school or high school. I don't know. But I think you could buy the same camera for the 17-year-old. I think the gratification you get from instant film is like, even my son who's 2.5, you know, like likes to hold, he knows what that is. He likes to hold it instantly. So I would say the same camera, depending on their like interest and skill level.
Do you think that's something to do with the fact that we take too many pictures with our phones these days? And so when you have a film camera, it's kind of a forcing function to make you take your time. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think the gratification comes a lot from that. I saw a video recently of this photographer doing instant film on like this old Land camera. It was like backstage at a rap concert. And it's amazing to peel these images apart and look at the picture, but the artists that he was shooting were just like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. And it is, but it's interesting that like, no matter what the age, it's almost the same reaction. Like what kind of, you know, amazement and curiosity, you kind of see it all. So,
yeah. Well, it's like pictures have become kind of a currency that is experienced inflation such that there's just so many. But when you have something that's tangible, that seems more rare. And that actually kind of leads my next question, which is, let's imagine you had two photographers. One read all the books on theory, had lots of picture books like that they collected and trying to understand different artists' approaches to, you know, framing pictures. But this photographer doesn't all take that many pictures themselves. And then you've got another person, they bought their first Canon 5D Mark III, and they're just out there shooting constantly. They have no sense of like theory or anything like that, but they're just shooting, 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 shooting. Yeah. Who do you think in the long run is going to be taking the better pictures?
B, the second guy.
Okay. So the need for theory and background is maybe a little bit overrated in terms of when it comes to producing good photos.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important, but even myself, I haven't spent a lot of time with theory. I mean, I've taken photo classes and stuff, but I've always learned just by like watching and doing. And that's kind of how I teach my students. There is theory with like composition and color and stuff like that. But like, I have a few students who this year, they're kind of the standout students because they went and did the most. Hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They actually did less in class because they were doing so much outside of class, and they were able to capture some really good images. But they're young enough in this art that sometimes they didn't even know that it was a really good image. Like I have one of them, she would show me her photos when she come back, and you know, she had one recently that was really good. And she's like, well, what about these ones? I'm like, well, I just can't stop thinking about this one. It's so good. And so it's interesting, like being like more than twice their age, just recognizing like, oh, I recognize a good photo because I've just done this a lot. It's not because I've read books or, you know, stuff like that. So
kind of along those lines, in terms of learning, what percentage of the educational content on YouTube about how to take pictures is bullshit?
I would say a high percentage, probably pretty high. I utilize YouTube in the classroom sometimes just to kind of back up what I'm trying to teach. But a lot of the stuff I come across, like when I'm just scrolling, it's just so annoying to me.
Like I can't, what do you find annoying? I really want to see through your eyes. What do you find annoying?
It's hard to get past like their approach because it doesn't seem authentic. A lot, I feel like, and I see this a lot with high school students. It's like when you're that age, you're trying to replicate what you're seeing these days online, and you're trying to have the same cadence to your voice and look the same. And so I feel like it all just feels the same. Not all of it, but most of the stuff that's at least showing up in my feed about photography, a lot of it's about gear or lighting.
There is an obsession with gear. And I often wonder that too. Like you'll see, I'm sure you've seen these before where you'll have a photographer that's like on a subway and like takes a picture of someone and like quickly edits it and then like shows it to him. Like, look at how good the picture is. And you see that kind of content a lot. And I mean, the photographs, it seems like we're not seeing the raw file, but we're just seeing you know, what they show on the YouTube video, it seems like a lot of it is just having really nice equipment more than anything interesting about how they frame the shot. Do you see a lot of that stuff too? What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I do see a lot of that. And I'm curious, like, what is it? What's the raw image look like? But I did see a video recently that it was like a comedic take on that, where it's like, here are my beautiful images, but here are the raw, you know, and they were just like complete garbage. And I thought about that. I was in Joshua Tree this last weekend, and I was like, oh, I got some good images. I was trying out a new lens, which I'm not really a gearhead, but there's a macro lens that I have and I'm trying it out. And when I got back and looked at them on my computer, I'm like, I don't know, let me put a filter on, you know, I was kind of that same, like, I don't know, man.
So I guess my next question is, when you talk to professional photographers, and, you know, there's a lot of them in Fresno, we're going to talk about kind of the landscape of photography in a little bit. What percentage of them are late bloomers, meaning people that didn't take pictures their whole life and that, you know, developed, like myself, like I'm getting into photography in my 30s, versus people that have been taking pictures their whole life?
Definitely a smaller percentage of, how you phrase it, late bloomers. But like, I had someone reach out to me recently who maybe was a little bit into photography, like in high school, and who was now probably in their 50s, and was like, hey, I'm gonna pick up my camera and this, you know. It's like, so I think photography is like huge right now in Fresno. There's a lot going on in the community. And so I think no matter what the age, as long as you're kind of tuned in to what's going on around here, I think that's just kind of contagious. So, to answer your question, I think the late bloomers, like yourself.
I've just started getting into photography the last year or two. And it was partly, I went to Yosemite with a friend who's very much into it, and he brought his equipment and I used it, and then I lost my mind. And then I was on KEH the next day, and, you know, here we go. So, you know, I think it's just what I derived was, you know, I could get one 24 to 70 millimeter lens. Mm-hmm. I could get, you know, an older Canon 5D, and I can bring that on most trips with me, and with a little Lightroom experience, I could, you know, document a lot of important trips and events in my life in ways differently than if I just am taking pictures with my phone. And so that was kind of my own kind of turn. But, you know, that kind of sudden interest, you know, it leads to some pretty big purchases. So, you know, it's, I think the average person may be a little hesitant to jump in, because I don't know if you feel this way, but sometimes people will buy some low-end equipment because they don't want to risk financially jumping in something. And then they get crappy images with their, you know, with their Canon Rebel with the stock lens. And they're like, why did I invest in this thing? It goes in a shoebox somewhere, and then their child finds it in 15 years. And can I have this camera? You know, I feel like I've seen that so many times with friends and family, where they're not willing to go all the way to invest in it.
Yeah.
And consequently, they're just disappointed, and then they lose interest.
Yeah. But I think, considering what you just said, I think sometimes people go in thinking that the good gear will instantly give them
good results. True.
Like we have in the class I teach, we have amazing cameras, and, you know, and I see a lot of stuff that isn't amazing. Hopefully my students won't hear this, but you know, it's just because they're learning, their first year students to photography, and they might not be totally sold, which is kind of my job. But so, yeah, I see both sides of that. Like, what's funny, or maybe ironic later, is that when that parent puts that crappy camera in a shoebox, their kid in like 20 years is going to dig it up and go, oh, look at this vintage camera, and they're going to shoot these amazing images, and their parents are going to be like, what the fuck? How do you do that? So I think a lot of it is instinct, and you probably have it, like, as far as like what got you interested at 30 and was some gear and images that you saw your friend shooting, but that seems pretty authentic. Like, it wasn't like you were online like, oh, I want to try to replicate what this guy's doing or whatever.
Yeah It was more just like I wanted to create images that I would come back to again, because, you know, sometimes you look through your, whatever they call it in an iPhone, like your camera roll, and you're like, God, there's just, most of it's like, mine is like a lot of screenshots of memes that have been entered into group chats. But then you'll get some actual pictures that I tried to take of things, and it's just, you know, the depth isn't right, you know, like it's just a pedestrian picture. And I have so much of those, and I felt like by spending this and also taking the time to focus on it, I'd create mm-hmm. things that I'd actually want to revisit versus just, you know, I think a lot of our camera rolls are garbage cans, you know,
they,
it's like when I just was in Europe a couple months ago, I guess end of March. Cool. And we went to this exhibit when we were in Paris that I really wanted to see. It was this impressionist exhibit that just came out for the week. And I was walking through the museum and there was, you know, like me, a lot of tourists there. And I saw this one man and he had his phone out. He had like whatever the biggest iPhone Pro is. And he was just walking from picture to picture, taking a picture of each of the paintings. And he wouldn't look at it. He would just snap a picture of the painting and then like turn, look at the picture and then look back up and then go to the next picture. And he'll never look at those again. I mean,
it's like
maybe
taking pictures of a firework.
Yeah. Well, like, we can go down this road a little ways. I want to change gears and get a little more specifics of photography. Is the rule of thirds overrated?
Great question. We aren't at the overrated, underrated section, right?
No. That'll come later. This is something where I really want to dig into it because when I was picking up photography, I picked up a couple of the books about, you know, composition and different things. And rule of thirds was mentioned in each of them. But then when I, you know, as people my age are want to do, go on Reddit, hear different perspectives. So I was curious about yours.
Yeah, I don't think it's overrated, but I think just like any like rule in photography or any other craft or art, it's like, it's important to understand it. And then, you know, like I think back when I was in high school, my sophomore year, I had a humanities class and part of that was like just making art. And I think it was my humanities class anyway, but my teacher commented, this is before any, like I've taken any photography class or art class, but my teacher commented like in front of the whole class, like, oh, look at Marco's. She was like so proud of it. And I didn't know why, you know, I was like, what is she talking about? But she pointed out like how I drew the birds in the sky. And she talked about the rule of thirds. And I'm like, to me, putting the birds there just felt right. You know what I mean? It was like more instinct, and that was kind of my first sign, like, oh, maybe I understand composition just naturally.
Well, then, I mean, it came from a place, right? Like it's a human created thing. Do you need to follow certain rules in order to produce a good picture? And I think you would say no, I would imagine.
Yeah, I don't think so. But I think teaching it, I try to show them these things in good photographs. Like, oh, yeah, here's some leading line. That's one of the reasons why this is pleasing to my eye, you know. But so it's hard. I'm always torn a little bit because I teach. And so I feel like I have to kind of go through these standards, but me personally, like I show my work a lot to my students. I've never really done that until this year. And I show them, I talk about like the situation and what was going on behind the scenes and the light, you know, we kind of break it down and we do the same with their work, but I don't know. I would say rule of thirds, not overrated, but not super, super important.
Okay. Do you think there are some downsides to just relying completely on autofocus? You know, I kind of have that setting turned on just automatically on my lenses. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious from your perspective, is there anything I'm missing out on by relying on that?
I would say like now, like the new cameras, there's a lot of like AI built in with like eye detection and face following. So it's easier to rely on it. And probably, I think I use it a lot. But
when do you not use it?
When do I use manual focus? I feel like I used manual focus a lot when I was first starting. Like I was doing maybe 15 years ago, I was shooting images at like a drumline competitions and they were moving a lot. And I would literally like, I was all in manual settings and everything was manual. And then I think back to that, I'm like, why? And maybe it was the camera at the time, but I didn't want to miss. I was more confident that I would see the focus than miss it with auto, because I still miss it sometimes with auto where it's like trying to, you know, maybe I have the wrong focus mode or whatever. These menus are so in depth that like every time you get a new camera or pick up a new camera and you try to learn, oh well, this one, yeah,
they are very confusing. And it's often a small screen and then you're swiveling through 100 options and then you forget what settings that you turned on. So this is something, it's kind of maybe more of a philosophical question. Do you err more on the side of getting all of your settings perfectly dialed in before you take a shot? Or do you more err on the side of, I'm just going to take the best shots I can and then I will spend a lot of time in Lightroom after the fact? Do you spend a lot more time in prep or do you spend a lot more time in post?
I would say prep or pre-production, like, but that's something I'm thinking about when I come into a room, for example, or wherever I am. It's like, okay, what's the light like? What does my ISO need to be at? Or what am I trying to achieve, right? Like if I'm shooting film, I took a trip to Bodie, which is a ghost town in the Eastern Sierras. And I knew that I wanted to get a set of images on film that were really like gritty and grainy. And so I chose a high ISO film. I overexposed, you know, like I was intentionally trying to do that. But so I would say definitely beforehand.
Okay. What are the downsides for post if you rely on a lot of post-production to make your images, you know, more aesthetically pleasing?
Again, like AI is becoming crazy. It's just the things you could do now in post-production on images is pretty dependable, but it's still more work you have to do. You know, it's like if I could get it done in camera and then make some minor like tonal corrections, and because that's what I'm doing with my tintype photography. It's like I scan that plate and I'm hoping all I have to do is desaturate a little bit because of the color, the temperature of the lights that I scan it with. But yeah, I don't want to do more work.
Yeah. Like, how important is learning how to do masking in post-production? How often do you actually use it? And is it maybe something that is not all that important? You know, I've messed with it recently when it comes to like looking at a sky or some kind of faraway landscape and wanting to adjust the color of maybe the blues in the sky or the horizon, but, or maybe a subject that's maybe doesn't have as much light as I want or something like that. Or do you use masking often?
Yeah, I would say more recently with like the new updates from Lightroom, it's like the auto subject.
Oh yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, and I think I discovered that last summer. I was doing a project for South Tower Community Land Trust, and you know, there I did like 7 photo shoots basically, and so there was a big mix of like locations and light and all kinds of stuff. And there was one shot that I really liked, but the subject needed to be, they were kind of underexposed. And I didn't want to blow out the whole thing by, you know. So usually I would take that into Photoshop and try it and then go, oh, that looks really bad. But now with Lightroom, I was like, holy crap, this is incredible. So,
yeah, no, I definitely, all the AI features are incredible. And it really makes it, I mean, you're just, your work time, your workflow is just so enhanced.
Yeah.
What do you think photographers can learn from cinematographers, from film? Are there certain things that you can pick up? I'm excited. I didn't get to see Furiosa over the last 2 weekends, but I'm going to finally go this weekend to see it. And, you know, George Miller's, you know, the cinematography in there is just so striking. And I'm just curious about, you know, kind of the bleed over between those two media.
They're so connected. I also teach a film class, so we watch a lot of films and analyze.
Who's your favorite cinematographer? What are movies that you like?
Oh gosh, I'm not good with names, but films I could think of, like anything Coen Brothers. I like the big landscape, you know, like No Country for Old Men.
Yeah,
it's just like these vast, you know, landscape shots composed, like it's really nice. And then Wes Anderson, of course, is like the symmetry in his work is, or his cinematographer. Trying to think of,
well, what do you pick up from them that you apply to photography
from those filmmakers?
From good filmmaking. Do you see things and go like, oh, I want to recreate that shot?
Yeah, I think kind of the play with like foreground to background and everything in between. In film class, it's called mise-en-scène. It's like the stage, or how it's crafted, how everything is arranged. And so when I watch films or TV, I'm picking up on that a lot. It's like not just composition, but like, why is this subject in the foreground and larger than the next? You know, it's like there's so much meaning that you could pull from all this stuff. And I think in photography, it's the same, but it just kind of has to happen more instant with photos. Like when I'm traveling, I love doing like street photography when I'm traveling. Sometimes I'll just kind of see these scenes in the street play out, and I try to capture kind of the whole vibe of it. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it's like, oh yeah, that didn't work out.
How much variation is there between a camera manufacturer? So let's say I'm someone getting into photography and I'm looking at a Canon, an Nikon, and a Sony. Is there any reason to choose any one of them necessarily, or should you just more focus on getting a stable body and then getting a quality set of lenses?
Yeah, I think the lenses, the glass is really important, because most stock, like if you buy a packaged kit from wherever, it's going to come with, you know, not great lens, but something you can learn with. But most people I speak with, it's like you usually stick to what you started with because you're comfortable. But I've also used like some Sony cameras that are really nice. It's just, you kind of have to like go outside of your comfort zone a little bit. And because there's manufacturers doing different things now, the technology is kind of taken off. So I wouldn't say there's one better than the other. Again, kind of like the taco situation, depends, or the taqueria, depends like what you're looking for. You go to the, you know, I'm a Canon shooter, but I've shot Sony, Lumix, all kinds of different.
All right. Last one before we get into the overrated versus underrated section. How did you get into the tintype photography and what gives it its kind of aesthetic uniqueness?
Yeah. So it was just kind of a rabbit hole I went down one day. I read an article or saw a post or video about this guy in Austin, Texas doing it. And it was like he was doing work for some brand, a watch brand or something. And anyway, that's it had such a unique look. And I was like, what is this? You know, and I'd heard of it, I think. Like, I don't even know. I'm like, I know this is like very analog process. And then I just went on a rabbit hole and looked up his work, which is amazing. And then from there, I was like, can I learn? How do you learn this? You know, so I try to find like workshops, and most of them are like East Coast or Midwest, you know. And I found a guy in San Jose, Alan Barnes, who I reached out to. He's also a teacher, a photo teacher in Morgan Hill. But that's how it started. It's like, reached out to him, did a workshop. It was like a one-day workshop. And then from that point, it was like a year of just experimenting. Like, can I do this on my own at my house? You know, like I'm not doing this in front of anyone except my wife. Like, she is my subject for the first year. And I still have like the first tintype I shot of her. And I love it because it's so, there's so many like innocent mistakes in it, but it looks really cool. So yeah, spent about a year trying to like just make it happen and slowly like purchase equipment. There's a lot of DIY in it. And that's the part I love and also hate about it.
Yeah. What about the images do you think that makes them so unique?
Well, it's the size of the image. So the smallest I shoot now is 4x5, and then the largest is 8x10. And that image is a direct positive image on that plate. So the clarity you get is crazy. Like it's like having a 4x5 negative or an 8x10 negative. So if you scan that at a high res and you blow it up, you cast that to like a TV, and the detail is so crazy. So I think that's a big part of it. It's also a reversed image. So I feel like you're seeing yourself, you know, in a different way, and the way it picks up color. So like reds are really dark and blues and greens are kind of lighter. So like the pigment in your skin, like I have a lot of red in my skin, so I look very dark, right? So, and then you have like your beard would have a lot of like cool texture. It's so far off from like what modern day cameras do that it makes people go, oh, what, you know, some people see themselves and they're like, oh, you know, but yeah. most people are like, wow, that is, it's like the, you know, holding the instant film, but you're seeing like, I'm essentially making a piece of film and then shooting on it and then developing it and then showing like we just did this, you know, like it's a whole process that from start to finish. So I think a combination of those things make it kind of a unique process.
All right, we're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. These are camera related things, favorite artistic photographers that I follow, just random stuff, like, you know, trends in photography. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. So the first one is disposable cameras, like the ones we had in high school when we went on some kind of trip.
Yeah.
And we'd wind them up and take a picture, and then we wouldn't know what the hell we had until, you know, a week after when our mom would drive to CVS and pick up the pictures.
Underrated. Okay, I'm looking for, I know I have a couple like lying around here. I was going to make.
Yeah, what do you use those for? I'm curious.
The last thing that my wife and I used them at our wedding, like know, at the table, and we still haven't gotten them all developed. But I would just say it's like an underrated party camera. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's there's the experience of like getting film developed. It kind of goes back to that. It's like that's such a cool experience to like not know what you just did, where you just shot. And you think about it, at least someone like me, I'm always like thinking about it. And then you see it and you're like either really disappointed or it's something so incredible. And I think just that going through that is important.
Okay. Next one. Me and Ed's Pizza, over or underrated?
You know, I heard you do this with Enrique Meza, I think. I don't know if I want to admit this. You know what I mean? It's one of those
things. Well, this is, you know, it's kind of a confession booth that everyone can listen into. So, you know, you can go at your own discretion.
Okay. So I think it's underrated, actually. It's not my favorite go-to pizza, but like if you have it like right out of the oven, once you take it, it's overrated. To go is not good. Okay. But I like it. I like if I'm having it there, I like it. My wife is not a fan and she always like gives me shit about it. But
yeah. Next one, the shallow depth effect on iPhones. Do you think that's just mainly stupid or does it have a function?
Yeah. On like in portrait mode or like cinema mode?
Yeah. So you'll have portrait mode and you know, because it's not really shallow depth. It's just creating kind of a layer, like a blur layer versus, you know, actual focus.
Yeah. And I just noticed that, like I've used it some, not a lot. And at first I was like, oh, this is so cool. And then recently I shot a photo of my son and I was like, yeah, it just looked like this like real flat blur layer. And I was like, I really like that. So
should people even use it? What do you think?
I think it's overrated. I don't think many people use it. I like the cinematic camera look or video camera. I like that mode. I use that more often than just the portrait mode. But
next one, another photographer I really like. Nan Golden, she did a number of beautiful images actually during the AIDS crisis where she would take a picture of someone and their back would be to the camera. They wouldn't be facing the camera and you could see like the shape of their body, but they're kind of, I guess what she was trying to articulate was kind of the anonymous nature of a lot of these, you know, deaths during a crisis.
Underrated. I came across that work recently, until you said the name, I kind of connected the two. Yeah, I think underrated, especially with photography like that and street photography, just kind of like seeing less is more maybe, or, you know, if you're going, I have this discussion with my students a lot. It's like, you don't have to show me everything, you know, like I don't have to see their face. It could still be a portrait. So yeah, underrated.
Okay. And then kind of related to that, I've seen this a lot recently where you have faceless shots where maybe the heads will be cut out of the frame. What do you think of that?
I would have to look at the image. I think with the right style, like there's some work of like some tattoo artists from London, like one of the first tattoo artists. And a lot of the focus is the work of, you know, that's on the body. And so there's, you know, you'll see it's like cut off at the mouth or whatever. And you don't really see the portrait.
Yeah, it's kind of the binging with Babish thing, you know, where you got the guy cooking and you just see just like torso down and you're just like watching their hands. And there's something. Yeah, it's just to me, it seems like it's just drawing attention to thing, you know, because we tend to be so face focused and then it forces you to look at other things is my read on it.
I agree.
OK, do we need more photo booths in our world? Should there be photo booths scattered across our streets? I mean, should we have a photo booth on the street on Olive?
Like a photo booth that prints? Like
yeah,
strips?
Prints photos.
Yes, dude. Those are so fun. Like, I think I could see myself at like 75, my wife and I getting into one of those. It's just like, I think maybe for someone my age, it's maybe a little nostalgic because that was like you went to the mall in the 80s or 90s and they were there, right? That's like what you did with your friends. But again, going back to the instant film thing, anyone I've seen all ages appreciate that. And you try to replicate that certain ways, but I think the getting in a tight space with someone or a lot of people, underrated.
Yeah. Next one, probably one of the most famous photographers, Annie Leibovitz.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think? Overrated or underrated her work? She's pretty highly rated as is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't really know how to answer. I mean, her work is incredible.
What do you like about it for someone that maybe doesn't understand why she's so highly regarded?
Well, in the beginning of the school year, I showed my students like some behind the scenes of her working with some models, and they were on this beach. And I think like that helped me understand why I like her work, is because she knows exactly like what she's going for. And she kind of is a good director. But I mean, that's kind of some of her more recent work, I think, in the last 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good start. Next one, using vertical orientation with a DSLR.
For photos?
Yeah.
Okay. Underrated.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm just curious, you know, going back to my recent trip to Europe, we were in a small town in Belgium, and there was a big clock tower, and my wife grabbed my camera and kind of corked it sideways and took a picture of the tower. And I was like, oh, that's right, I can turn the camera. You know, you don't, I feel like some bigger bodied cameras, you don't see people turning them as much and using that vertical orientation.
That's an interesting observation. I think, well, especially if you're on like a tripod, some tripods are, it's easier. Like I experienced that this weekend in Joshua Tree. It's like, if you're on a ball head tripod, it's easy to go boop and turn it.
Why would you turn it? Just to show the height of something?
Yeah, just if the composition, like I did a kind of a landscape shot. It was a Joshua Tree, and way back were like the mountains and the sun was setting. So I liked the landscape shot, right? But then when I turned it vertically or portrait mode, then I was more focused just on that single Joshua Tree. So yeah, it just depends. I shoot, when I'm doing portraits, it's mostly all portrait mode, vertical.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because I'm a handheld, and it's just like that to me feels natural. This landscape, I don't know.
It's interesting. Well, maybe my observation is not based on the typical thing that a photographer does. It's just my observation. All right. Last one. Direct flash. Over or underrated?
Overrated.
Okay. So, you know, everyone's been at a wedding where the photographer's got some big flasher and, you know, it's the middle of the dance floor and it makes sense, but it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of situations where that makes sense.
Yeah. That's also kind of a trend right now, I feel like, that I don't think is going to last. Maybe it's already gone. I don't know. I remember maybe 6 months ago seeing more work, and then I saw a video talking about this is a trend, like high contrast, big flash portraits. It's cool looking. It's very like kind of retro, and like you get like this natural candid movement. So it's fun, but I think it's a little overrated.
Okay. All right, let's jump into our next section, which is I'm calling the future of photography. You mentioned some of the AI tools that you like in Lightroom. I guess I'm going a little negative here. So if we rely too much on AI tools to help us produce good photos, are we going to lose our ability to produce good photos?
I don't think we'll lose the ability, but so there's this photographer named Tim Tatter. A friend of mine has worked with him, and really good photographer. All his recent work is all AI, though. It's weird. Like, at first, it kind of seemed like he was just trying to prove a point, like, you know, against AI, like anti-AI. But now his images are beautiful. But I wouldn't call them photos. You know, that's like, I was thinking about this. It's like, I think, if anything, AI, with some of the work I'm seeing that's fully AI produced, they're images. And they could be fine art. They can be beautiful. But that doesn't necessarily make them photographs, because the tools you're using to create them are prompts, and it's like you're telling a story to get an image. Whereas with photography, your hands are on a tool. So I think there's, you have to like make that distinction first, is like there's a photograph and then there's images.
What do you make of the trend that we're seeing with a lot of, I mean, you see commercials for this all the time about like, you know, some of the photo editing things that are available on smartphones, where you can just like cut a person out of a picture or slide a subject to the side. You know, it's really kind of altering our understanding of what a photograph is. And sometimes in life, you know, there's trends you don't want, and then there's times where you just have to change your definition of a word. So what do you make of these new tools that are emerging?
I think at some point, I think they're, at first glance, it's like, holy shit, they're really cool. Like I went to the Adobe conference last year, and they highlighted a lot of that stuff, and everyone, the crowd is like, ooh, and like clapping, you know, it's like the old Steve Jobs videos anyway. But I think, you know, at first glance, it's like, look what I can do. And then when you try to apply that realistically, it's like, I haven't personally found a huge need for it, but I think at some point those things will iron out and it will, like, these five cool things will become one important thing, you know?
Do you think AI is going to make it easier to steal photographs, where you can take someone else's image and tell AI to kind of contort it a little bit, but keep the style the same? Are you fearful of that, you know, in terms of,
well,
you know, everyone's going to have their unique watermark or something?
Yeah, it's already kind of happening. Like, I don't know if you've recently, there was some stuff that came out about Adobe that they're pushing AI in a large way, obviously, because that's their business. But they had an ad or something that posted and it said, like, skip the photo shoot or something. So now you have all these photographers on, like, Reddit and everywhere else, like, you know, just talking shit about Adobe. But I don't know. I think I'm not, like, afraid of AI. AI is, it's like thinking back to like 1996 or something like that. And I remember asking my older brother, what is the internet? You know, like that, that's what I was asking that many years ago. And so now I think of like what AI is going to be in 20, 30 years. And it's like, oh, of course. Yeah. This is what it is.
Yeah. So I think most people that are nervous about it are nervous because they feel like they're going to lose a monopoly on some kind of aspect of life. Like, you know, you produce, you're an artist, you produce things, and now we've got AI artists. And so it's like the environment's more complicated. And I think that, I think change just scares people. And that makes sense to me. And that kind of leads me to my next question, which is, you know, if you had a crystal ball and you were going to use it, what do you think? Do you think the same ways that photographers make money today is going to be the way they make money in 20 years? Or do you think that's going to change?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Because people are still going to get married. People are still going to have babies. Yeah. And people still need portraits. But I just wonder if it's going to change in some ways.
I think the need for a photographer to be in a physical location will always be there. Yeah, I don't see that going away. And maybe that's why I'm not nervous about it. If anything, I think that myself or any future photographer will find a way to use it if they're smart. You know, it's like, I'm not gonna quit photography because people are making shitty AI stuff. But there's also beautiful AI stuff. Like, you know what I mean? Like there's two sides of it. So
yeah.
It's hard to say.
Yeah, it is a complicated question. Do you anticipate that at some point down the line, phone cameras will be so good that will make DSLRs obsolete? Or do you think, because I was talking about this with another photographer friend, and his quip to me in response was, well, DSLRs keep getting better every year. So it's like, you know, it's a moving target for an iPhone, where, you know, iPhone could, you know, it's still light years below, you know, what the top Canon models and lenses you can get. And those keep getting better. And even if an iPhone keeps getting better and better, it's, again, a moving goalpost.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I could take incredible photos with my iPhone. Like I have, like, there's just, it blows me away that like I can do that, that this little piece of technology can do that. But yeah, like you were saying, the DSLRs, like some of the new, I think it's this, some of the new Sony stuff coming out where it's like different type, a global shutter. There's all the, like, I'm not like a huge tech guy, but some of this stuff, it's almost like, and storage is so cheap too now. Right. So it's like, I feel like you can just record something happening and then go back and go, oh yeah, I want this frame from it. And it's going to be like the perfect frame, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause you could shoot so many frames a second now with this new type of shutter. So like sports photography, anytime you're trying to freeze action is like, it makes it really easy. So I think that's good. I don't know.
Yeah. Let's jump into some Fresno questions. Yeah. Do you think Fresno photographers spend enough time with each other?
Yeah. You know, I love Fresno and I love a lot of Fresno photographers. There's so many. And I remember seeing this kind of blooming like less than 10 years ago. I just remember thinking like, oh, there's some new, maybe it's when I started feeling like I was getting older and there were like these young kids like getting into film and starting to do like meetups and stuff. I was like, that's freaking awesome. So can you say the question again?
Well, I guess, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm asking you what the benefits are of photographers meeting up with each other, you know, because I think it's easy to be an isolated photographer and never have other people look at your work other than your clients. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some ways, I'm asking what the benefit of that is and if we do it enough.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, I think there's a huge benefit to being part of a community that's like doing what you're doing. But there are a lot of different types of photographers. You know, there's some that are only shooting film. There's some that are only shooting digital. But I've been to some of these. They're my friend Diego and Edgar. They've kind of like put together this photo walk. I don't know if you're tuned into this, but I think they're on their fourth one happening in this weekend. And it started like the very first one I went to, it was like maybe 20 or 30, maybe like 25 ish people. We met up downtown and it was cool. I was like, oh, this is the first time we're trying this out. And it was like kind of all ages and everyone brought their like really unique different kinds of types of cameras. And it was just a very accepting, inviting community to be a part of for that hour or two. And then like the last one, which I did not go to, there were like, I forget the number he told me, but it was this huge, amount of people, and now like Horn Photo is sponsoring it. And so it's like, it's really evolved into something really cool. And my question to him, one of the organizers, is like, is that, I asked him if that's a little scary, like, is it going to get too big? And then like, all of a sudden it's not cool, you know, like, you see that a lot in Fresno. It's like a new restaurant opens and then it's, you know, it's like that whole evolution. But no, I really, that's one of the things I love about Fresno is like, with any art or craft or ambitious idea someone may have, there's always like three people that are going to back you up and help you. You know what I mean? And then that kind of snowballs. And I think that's a really unique thing about living here is, you know, you can have some confidence that someone's going to understand your vision and someone's going to support it. And someone's probably going to buy your work. Like, that's just Fresno. I love it.
Hmm. Next one's maybe a little touchy question. Are there too many wedding photographers in Fresno?
I don't know, man.
Seems like there's a lot.
Yeah, there are. There's got to be a ton.
I just wonder about the quality of the work. You know what I mean? Like, that's something I wonder about. And, you know, that's a big expense for a lot of people on their wedding day. And you've shot weddings and shoot weddings. Can you talk about, you know, why it is such a big expense in terms of the time that it takes you and the prep and the post and all that kind of stuff?
The risk as a photographer, like I wouldn't call myself a wedding photographer. I've shot weddings. I don't necessarily, that's kind of not my avenue, but I'll shoot maybe one or two a year. And usually it's just word of mouth. Like, you know, I think whatever, it just kind of happens naturally, but I don't know. I don't know if there are too many, but I know several who are really good, and I try not, just like any other type of photography or anything else. It's like, if you're on Instagram, there's a lot of it. Right. And the way my brain works these days is like, I'm trying to like get rid of all the garbage, not saying they're garbage, but like the stuff that doesn't inspire me or mean anything.
Because there is a style, right? There's a style that a lot of photographers have, and they just kind of replicate it. And then they post it on Instagram, and then people say, oh, that's what a wedding photo looks like. So I want to seek that particular style. And so maybe people don't want innovation when it comes to their wedding day, which I understand.
You know, right. It's
too artistic, you know?
Yeah. And for many years, I was a second shooter for a photographer friend of mine. And I loved doing that at weddings because there was no pressure on me. I was like, I'm going to shoot whatever I want. And some of my best wedding images was when I was a second shooter. I was there getting paid a couple $100, you know, it was like, I just showed up, shot, gave my SD cards, handed them over at the end of the whatever. And so that, I don't know, that's why there's no way I could do that for a living. Like, just shoot weddings. I just can't handle the pressure, man.
Yeah. Okay. Next one. Another Fresno question.
Yeah.
What things in Fresno aren't photographed enough?
Things in us.
So people in Fresno people. Aren't photographed enough.
I think, and that's kind of what recently I've been looking at my own work with the tintype process is like, I'm commissioned to do portraits. Then I do a lot just on my own. because I think this person looks interesting, or I'm just trying out a new technique or whatever. But when I really think about like, why am I doing this? Cause it's so tedious. It's, you know, I get a lot of joy from it, but I've been asking myself that a lot. Like,
yeah,
getting home yesterday, I'm like, I could just kind of stop doing it and then like pick up, like, maybe I'll get a, maybe it's like midlife crisis. I don't know, but
yeah. I think that happens in all creative projects where you say, where you start to, you feel like maybe you're losing for the passion and you're not sure if you just need a break or something new. I get that.
Yeah, no, but I always get the same amount of joy from shooting a tintype every time. It's like, sometimes I'm more excited than the people sitting in front of me. I know I'm still on the right path because I'm getting more ideas and trying new things out, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. Last question on this subject. And I always ask people this, what has doing photography in Fresno taught you about Fresno?
Well, I kind of touched upon that in the two questions ago, is like doing photography in Fresno has reminded me of how powerful having a community is. And it's like that in the music scene here. Like before I moved to Fresno, it was the music is what kind of like, oh, this is really a special place. And now that I've lived here for almost 20 years, it's like in all facets of the art community, it's the same way. So I think just the amount of support you can get doing something new, like look at Tower Porch Fest, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's a great idea. Someone organize it. And then now it's like this huge thing. And it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we had Jeremy Hoffer on the show recently, and
okay,
just to think about, you know, cause when we were talking about it and he talked about, you know, when it started, and then I went this year and I was like, oh my God, like, you know, insane. any major city, you know, would want that level of success that they had in just creating something brand new. And I think it's a combination of good idea plus right environment plus right time. You know, Tower has got a kind of like all hands on deck approach to a lot of things. And, you know, one of the questions I asked Jeremy was whether the Porch Fest would work in other parts of Fresno. And, you know, he kind of, I think, nicely shook his head, which I think makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
All right, let's close with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Oh, so I wrote a few down. I feel like the ones I wrote down, it's more like, so I recently read Rick Rubin's The Creative Mind.
Ooh, I've been wanting to read that. Did you like it?
Yeah. Well, I did the audiobook because I did it as I drove and stuff. But yeah, I mean, he's so insightful. And, you know, I love that he acknowledges, like, I'm not a musician. I'm just there to kind of like feel the vibe out and say like, try this, you know, like he's just like, just presence the room. That's really powerful. But his approach I like, because it's like a lot of us get stuck on saying like, oh, I'm a creative, or they're creative, I'm not creative. You know, it's like, you hear that all the time. And his idea is that like, well, everyone's a creator. Like, and he breaks down like the most simple way, like, but that's an excellent read. If you haven't read that. And then there was another book called, this one was, I saw someone posted it on Instagram, one of the people I follow, and someone by the name of Jocelyn Glee, G-L-E-I, and it's called Manage Your Day-to-Day, Sharpen Your Creative Mind. So to me, that was like, oh, I need to read that, because being older and being a dad of a 2.5-year-old, it's like trying to find the time to be creative or just like do my creative work becomes more challenging. So that book's all about like kind of scheduling for yourself the time to make that happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think everyone who's created anything has experienced that, where you're just kind of in this zone. You're like, oh, this is just happening. It's like jazz, you know. That was a really good read. It was a quick read, but it had some good insight. And then anything Bukowski, I just like his like really dark, beautiful way of like seeing his own world. Like, and again, getting older, I could relate to a lot of the stuff. Like, oh yeah, he's just such a grumpy old man, but he writes.
It's funny you chose him, because he was, in my mind, you know, I think of like a photography poet or someone that gives you like such a crystal clear image of just some nasty hotel room.
Oh yeah.
You know, like he's perfect.
Oh, it's beautiful. I've read several of his books, and then I have this book. It's just like his poetry. So it's just this like it's a bunch of his poems, and I just have it highlighted and bookmarked. Like I'll come back to this every like 6 months and just start reading in the morning and go, oh yeah, the way, just the way he like looks out a window and observes. I'm like, yeah, I love it.
Yes. Well, and I think he's such a great, you know, poet to kind of provoke conversation about what's going on right there. And you know, such an interesting perspective, I would say. Mm-hmm. Well, what are you working on these days? Is there photography projects that are in the works? And what can you share about if people want to do a tintype photo? How do they go about scheduling that and booking that with you?
So projects, yeah, I have some stuff coming up. I shot a portrait of an artist named Macy Collard, I believe is her last name. She was in Fresno and she's living in Oregon now, but she's having a show next year. This is like her, I think she's turning 30. I don't want to give too much away. I don't know if she would appreciate that, but anyway, she has like this kind of concept that her and I are working with, and she's using all Fresno artists to collaborate with her own work. It's a really interesting idea that she has, but anyway, so I'm working on that end of this month, which is fun. I always like collaborating with other artists. And then I'm trying to plan. I've never had a show. Like I've never showed my work anywhere. I mean, here and there, but like I've never had a, like, here's my work, you know, like in a single group. I've never done that. Probably because I'm just afraid like anyone else. But anyway, JSA reached out to me and asked if I wanted to, and that would be, and I told her like, of course. Yeah. Like I'd be stupid to say no. Cause that's like the one location where I'm like, I would love to see my work in that building.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm going to go chat with her, I think this week at some point, and that's in the works in the next, hopefully 6 to 8 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm just always have these like ideas for experiments with portraits. Like I'm working with Mike Adame on like some, you know, those like hologram cards that you would get in like, I don't know if that's an old thing in the '80s or nineties. Those are printed on what's called lenticular sheets. And so him and I are trying to figure out a way to do like holograms with tintypes where I shoot directly on that. And I don't know, it's all these crazy ideas, but if you want to book a tintype, best way is probably just to like reach out via Instagram. There's a link on my profile that like has my schedule, but right now my schedule is opening up a lot because I'm about to be on summer break. So best thing to do is just send me a message and then we'll make it happen.
Well, Marco, this has been a lot of fun. I feel like we got to get into the weeds a little bit and then think more broadly about photography in Fresno. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.